I see we have three guests.
And we do. We have D.W. Gibson, who's director of the residency program for writers, now taking place at Art Omai.
Sounds like a sinecure to me, but okay. It is, right?
Will,
right?
No, not officially, no.
Okay.
And two of the writers, if I can pronounce their names correctly.
I think one's easy.
Justin Goh is with us.
Yeah.
And Justin, when I explained that you lived in both the United States and Europe, one of our interns said, how is that possible? So how is that possible?
It requires a lot of suitcases and stored in my parents' garage. But I've wondered how it's possible myself, but once you get used to it, there's no going back. I usually spend the summer in Europe and the winter in California because it's warmer there.
That's a good explanation.
Pretty nice for a writer's life there.
And Sonia Lorenchik. I practiced, but I'm not sure.
Nice try. Hello, everybody. I'm Sanja Lovrencic, and I come from Croatia.
Do you hear that, Jake? Croatia. Jake's Croatia, brother and sister are going to Croatia this summer. They are.
So, and we're going to ask you to read for us at some point. But let's ask Dan to tell us more about the program and how writers are chosen, and you can stretch that out if you don't want to bend over quite that far.
Yeah, so the writing program is part of the Omai International Arts Center in Ghent.
Mm-hmm.
And we have about a 300-acre campus, 150-acre sculpture park. And throughout the year, we invite artists working in various forms, visual art, dance, music, writing.
We've had other parts of the program here.
So, and those programs rotate throughout the year. So, in the spring and fall, we have writers here. And we have usually about 8 to 10 people with us at a time. Generally speaking, no more than 2 or 3 of them are American. So, we have writers working in various languages and translators, too. So, we have poets, fiction, nonfiction, screenwriters, playwrights, you name it. And they all live and work together and share some meals and get some work done. It's about trying to encourage them in their work, give them space to do their work, and also establish a community with their peers from other parts of the world.
And you're also a literary scout, right?
I have been doing that in the past, but I retired from that.
Oh,
yeah, just one too many jobs.
Oh,
so.
I see. I thought you had poached enough of these writers from the program to retire.
In the past, but that life is behind me now.
Okay.
So yeah.
How many years have you been running the program?
It frightens me to say this summer it will be 10.
Really?
I know. It's shocking to me, but it's true. 10 years. I've been there since 2005. So, and the organization's been around, we're coming up on our 25th anniversary, so we've been around for a while now. Yeah.
And we should tell our listeners, if you're ever interested in applying, go to Art Omai, and all the process for applying for the various programs are there. And they have, occasionally someone local has turned up, especially in the art program, I've noticed.
Yeah.
But I take it, how many applicants you get, for example, for this session of writers?
So we have about 20 spots available each year, 20 to 25 spots, and we get about, it depends on the year, about 250, 300 applications for those spots. The visual art program is much more competitive. They have about 30 spots, and they get about 1,000 applications, I'm pretty sure.
Mm.
So what do you provide the writers with when they're there? How long a time are they there for?
So they're coming and going the spring here. We started in March. We call that spring, which is, as we all know, very funny. And over the course of 2.5 months, each comes through for about 4 weeks is the average stay. And we provide them with a fully funded residency, which means when they arrive at our doorstep, no expenses. We give them housing, great food. We give them.
Justin, is the food great?
Say it's great.
It's very good. Even if it wasn't being extorted from me, I would admit that.
and we bring publishing guests up every weekend, so they have a chance to meet editors and agents and people from that world and make connections there. We provide all of that. Don't provide travel, though, so folks are responsible for getting themselves here. But once they get to the train station in Hudson, they're in our hands.
So you say 4 weeks out of 2.5 months. You mean they go back and forth, or they stay for the 4 weeks from when they arrive?
They stay for 4 weeks.
They have an option of when they can come up and do it?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And how did you use your 4 weeks? I forgot your first name.
Sonia.
Anna, sorry.
Sonia,
sorry.
Well, I've been here for 3 weeks now and have 1 week to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really very grateful to all my people that they have chosen my application for this stay, this four-week stay, because it's been great working here. And, well, the food's great, too.
Ah. So you've just been eating the whole time?
No. I came here with a half-finished book, and it's a book of short stories, and I am almost finished now with the first draft, so it has been really very useful.
I imagine just having the daily necessities taken care of makes a big difference in your writerly life on a day-to-day basis.
That's a lot about what it's about, because it's hard to describe not only the time you need to accomplish what you need to accomplish as a writer, but the quality of that time.
Right.
And so not having all those interruptions is, it sounds like such a simple thing, but it's a really big thing to provide, I think.
No, I know. Every time I sit down to do a project, I start thinking about what I'm going to make for dinner or lunch or breakfast. You know, it's just, it's endless. And it's the great way to avoid doing anything. Justin, what have you accomplished in your, where are you in your 4-week stay?
I'm halfway through, and I've written a tremendous amount. I've been working on my second novel. Mm-hmm. And my book came out last year, and honestly, although I'd been working on it for more than a year, my first book had come out, I'd been working for a year on my second book. I had not done much because it's so easy to be distracted, and especially if you're doing something challenging, you just won't do it. So, I mean, there's one benefit to being at the residency, which is that you have this time. But there's also this benefit that you're just sort of forced to work because you know that now is the time. And whatever problem there is, you just have to overcome it. And if it means abandoning it or changing your book, you know, you just have to deal with it. And so I dealt with it, and then I've already been, you know, writing a tremendous amount. And before I came to the residency, I was just not writing because I knew there were things I had to figure out, which I didn't want to figure out.
Do they lock you into your rooms?
No, it's the time honored system of peer pressure. You see everybody around you working hard.
Right.
Somebody at dinner, you know, yesterday was like, "I just had the best writing day I've ever had," and then everybody else just like hangs their head in shame.
I was going to ask if there's any competition around the dinner table.
Occasionally, there's that. But you know, I think we try to create an environment of sort of collaboration, and I think Justin hit it on the head. It's that feeling of knowing that everyone else is or supposedly, allegedly working so hard in the room that it motivates you to do so, and you know, calls your bluff on being a writer. If you've had all these distractions in your life and now they're all taken away, you've got to sit down and do the work.
Right.
Well, if I may add, those evening conversations are very, very interesting in different ways. You know, we've been discussing all sorts of things connected with writing and not with writing, discussing a title for a colleague's new book, things like that. And we were talking about words, which writers usually do. With normal people, you don't have so much opportunity to do that.
Oh, you don't listen to this show obviously. We talk about words constantly.
We were talking about words today.
Today.
And we're talking about dictionaries.
Actually. We're trying to train our interns how to use the OED. It started by explaining what the OED was. Anyway.
First you get a magnifying glass.
Or a very expensive online subscription.
That's what I was talking about. Especially if you want the updated one.
Right.
You also have a book that you're... Let's just take a break from Omai and learn... You're going to do a reading somewhere of your new book.
I am, yes. Next Friday, a week from tomorrow, I'm going to be reading at the Chatham Bookstore. The books I do are nonfiction, and they're based in oral history. So my book is called The Edge Becomes the Center, and it's an oral history of gentrification. Mm-hmm. So for about 3 years now, I've been interviewing people in New York City, tenants, landlords, politicians, drug dealers, business owners, you name it. About changes in New York from their perspective, and I've compiled that into a book. And it's interesting, you know, we think about gentrification in terms of an urban experience, but I take a look out the window here in Hudson, and I see a lot of the same themes that play out in New York City.
Yes, we need to talk to you about that a later time, because there's a lot of gentrification going on. We who are probably looked upon as part of the gentry...
Well, you especially.
Do not like to have it called gentrification, but
If I learned anything, I learned that this is a very toxic word that everyone defines on their own terms.
Right. Yeah. So,
what's the event at OMI? Getting back to that one.
Yes.
Yeah, so I am merely the opening act on Friday. Next Saturday, the 16th, at the OMI Arts Center and the Visitor Center of our sculpture park, we're going to host a reading that will feature all of the current residents.
How many?
We'll have about 9 people reading.
Whoa.
5 p.m. Well, it's like a trailer. It's like okay. One movie trailer after another, you know, so it never ends. It's great. And it'll be about an hour-long reading, and then we'll have a barbecue, free and open to the public. So come on and join us.
And Omai does books. This every year, I think. The barbecue is always during the writer's residency.
Yeah, we actually do it twice a year because the writers come in the spring and the fall, so we usually do it in May and in September. September, it's often questionably identified as a barbecue because it's often feeling very fall-like, but we still call it a barbecue. Uh-huh.
Would you say the majority of the writers will read from something they wrote while they were here, or will they just read from anything?
That's a good question. You know, most read from something that's already done and polished. Mm. Every now and then we have some brave souls that read something that's a work in progress, which is really exciting when that happens. But yeah, most people stick to stuff that's already been polished, but maybe Sonia and Justin can give some sneak previews about what they might do.
Mm-hmm. And also there was a reading at the Hudson Wine Merchants gallery, upstairs gallery. When was that? It was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, the 18th of April we did one there. Yeah, Michael and Marianne, who run the wine shop and then also the gallery upstairs, they're great hosts. Mm-hmm. And we do a reading there every spring.
Great. Well, any other questions, Tom?
Oh, I have tons of questions, but let's hear some reading first.
Okay.
That'll inspire more questions.
Who wants to go first?
Sonia?
I think Sonia has some poetry for us.
Oh, boy.
Great.
Yeah, I came here actually to write some short stories, but as I write in Croatian, it's not easy to transfer them into English quickly enough for this. So mm-hmm. I have chosen two poems from my newest book, which was published in February this year. And those are two Scrabble poems. New words. Burslok might be the term for the insolence of people armed with sandpaper. Oh my God, they just go around braiding. Olulate is a very noble fruit, which grows in hidden glades in the rainforest. And rare are those who have ever tasted it. But those who have... In another place, same means different. In the north, at the moment when permafrost starts melting, Olulate is the name of a lame freon that would finally take off if it weren't held down by Druola, the call of the depths. Anyway, Burslok is up, Olulate down, at the bottom of the sea. New words. Ipinawa is a lost Greek verb that means to whimper, going in circles, alone. Shilium is a Latin noun with a Slavic sh, you might say corrupted. The name of the town where misguided masters end up. Uncertain about their choices, they produce glass slippers and clocks going backwards, inventing virtuoso excuses, part-time. It is dear is a Greek verb too. If it were Latin, it would mean, I too hate God a little bit. But in Greek it says, I'm putting a candle on the table. You put out some olives and the cheese.
I'm never playing Scrabble with Sonia.
Are you a Scrabble player?
Well, actually, no, but those were written during a sort of artistic experiment. Well, a friend of mine, a visual artist, she made a huge Scrabble out of clay, and she invited several writers to come and play with words. So we did it, and well, I liked the game very much, so I kept those poems for my book.
Well, you should check out a book by our local rock star poet, Stephen Merritt, called 101 Words, two-letter words for Scrabble. It's really very funny. And by the way, he's a BFF. Right, Alan? You know.
BFF. You know what a BFF is.
Is BFF Scrabble eligible?
No. I'll have to ask him if he remembers me when I call.
We'll ask the intern. Yeah. The intern knows all.
Well, that was beautiful.
Yes. Thank you very
much.
That's
what poets should be doing, you know? Playing with words. Making up words. Some of these, you know, more... What shall we call them? Demotic poets. Leave me cold. I have very strong views about poetry, but we need not go into it.
We could use some new words.
I have lots of friends who are poets. Too many.
Too many poets?
Too many friends. Too many friends.
Okay.
So, Justin, you want to, quote, go? Sorry, that was lame. Lame but irresistible.
There's been many people in my life who've been unable to resist the same joke.
I know. Sorry.
So it's
the name of the novel is
The Steady Running of the Hour, and it's my first novel, and it was published a year ago. So
by
Simon & Schuster,
ah.
And it just came out in paperback. And it's sort of the story of a young man who sort of searching for the past. And the story that the part that I'm going to read is about is a kind of a conversation between a man and a woman who just met. One of them, the man's a soldier, an officer in the First World War, and this is 1916, and he's talking about mountain climbing. And a lot of what the book is about is sort of like impossible tasks, or why people do things that are very difficult and what that means to them. And so in this scene, I was trying to kind of capture the way that the climbers, the early climbers who went to Mount Everest in the 1920s felt about what they did. But also this thing that's still around in mountain climbing now, which is that you don't want it to actually talk about what it is. So she's trying to get him to talk about it. They're in a cafe in London. So it starts off and she says, she asks him to talk about it. And he says, talking about it doesn't do any good. The best parts can't be explained. You might try. I'd like to understand. Ashley frowns, capping his pen. He takes a silver case from his tunic pocket and lights a cigarette, setting the case on the table. Imogen takes a cigarette for herself, and Ashley raises his eyebrows. You're going to smoke in here? She gives a coy nod in reply. Ashley lights her cigarette and stares down in the cut glass ashtray. He begins to speak, his words coming slowly and deliberately. It is impossible to live without danger, Ashley explains. The danger is always there, the hazard of wasted lives, of decades bent over a desk, of squalid and lonely deaths in hospital beds. Fools turned their faces away from danger and pretended at immunity, but others went to the fountainhead of life. And what, Imogen wonders, is that? Ashley taps his cigarette on the ashtray. I couldn't say. It's different for every man. Or woman, she says. But what is it to you? There isn't a name for it, Ashley says. One could call it endeavor or struggle or give it a name, but then it only sounds silly. It's something one needs that isn't essential, something one wants for no good reason at all. Not an animal desire, a desire that comes not from one's body, but from one's soul. But why do you want it? She says. I can't explain it. You have been explaining it. Please go on. Ashley looks at the tablecloth and shakes his head. He says that for one thing, lasting comfort becomes no comfort at all. All things in this world are perceptible only by contrast. For just as there is no heat without cold, nor light without darkness, it is climbing that throws all of Ashley's life into sharp relief. It is climbing that makes one feel. It is the driving mountain cold that makes the fire in an alpine hut so delicious. It is the sore and cramped muscles that transform an ordinary hot bath into a sensory revelation. It is the hours of grueling ascent that make a supper of sardines and biscuits and jam so much better than 1,000 dinners at the Criterion. It's the little things that bring one down, Ashley says. Delayed trains and burned puddings in drafty rooms. I was never so miserably cold on a mountain as I was in a drafty room. One can rise to dire occasions, but most of the time one worries about one's burnt pudding. It takes real struggle to see what life is. Then you realize you don't give two straws if your pudding's been burnt. Imogen watches Ashley across the table. Her gaze is steady and unblinking, her hand turning the silver band around her wrist.
Very nice. Have you ever read Soldier of the Great War?
No, I actually don't really read historical fiction because I'm always worried it's
not really. It's Mark Halperin?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
I mean, I don't. I'm always worried about mixing up other people's ideas of the past with my own.
Oh, okay.
So.
Got a lot. It's a lot about the alpinists during the war.
Yeah, I've heard it's good.
Yeah, it's very good. Anyway.
Maybe it's okay now.
Exactly. Very nice. When you write something with a historical base, do you find how much do you research?
For years, I mean, I researched this book even into copy editing. So I wound up recently. It took me 7 years to write this book, including all this time involving, becoming a writer and getting an agent and all that stuff. And I was researching the whole time from when I started the book until literally like the last possible moment I could still change it. I was checking things. So there were distinct phases in which I was just researching, like maybe a year. But then there's also just like researching happening all the time. So that's like my approach, but that's also really exhausting. And I don't know if I'm going to do it again for this book, although I've started that way.
How much did you research the language of the period?
It's a huge thing, yeah, a lot.
Because I noticed a couple of idioms in what you read were kind of, you know.
Right, I mean, it's essentially a whole another language that's vanished, and what you're trying to do is recreate it. The good thing is that you can read, depending on your sources, you can be researching for several things at once. So I was reading letters and diaries for my for my research anyway.
But yeah.
So that kind of doubled both as factual research and learning to speak this language. And I kept a diary of the words and phrases from the period. But I mean, it really is like a language, and you don't know how these people spoke. But the best approximation is the things that they wrote to each other and how they wrote down in their diaries. And so, yeah, that was a huge challenge, but it's also kind of a thrill to learn how to do it.
Yeah, the one historical novelist, or quasi-historical novelist I was close to, I used to be her assistant, was this woman named Mary Lee Settle. I don't know if you ever heard of her. But that's what she would do for her novels about the history of West Virginia. She'd create a whole room just of maps and documents and, you know, books that were from the period and all that kind of thing, and clothing, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a lot easier if you just find yourself essentially kind of living in the period. And you become interested in it, and you have the sensibility. I mean, I really kind of, I wrote about this period because I liked it, but it also just became kind of like my taste. And when I read books for fun, I read books from the period, and I got into, you know, I would look at art, and I was interested in the art of the period, and it became very inseparable. And so it's easier than that. You're not really miming anymore. It's just what you like and what you're living for that period.
Did it change your day-to-day language? Did you take on any of it as your own?
I don't know. I hope not. I mean, that would be really pretentious. But I think in a sense, of course, that you don't know like what things sort
it's
of go into.
It's funny,
life.
Ellen asked that because, you know, whenever I've read a new P.G. Woodhouse novel, I start using phrases, and all my friends say, "You're such a pretentious fool." You know, it's like, but you can't help it. You can't help it. You know. Anyway, so is your next, the book you're working on, is that also historically based, or is it?
Yeah, my next book is set in the late 1920s and 1930s, also in Europe, all over Europe, and principally in like Germany and France. So yeah, so it's the same thing. I mean, with the added complication of having like foreign languages, which makes it even worse. Yeah.
Ellen, you're not on the mic, Ellen.
Sorry. Thank you. You get to take off on your income tax. Well, if you pay income tax in the United States, I'm confused already. But all the travel expenses you have to do for research are business expenses, aren't they?
Yeah, it is.
Are you an IRS rep? Jeez.
It's very smart, and actually, it's a serious benefit because it's true. I mean, everything. Of course, for a writer, it's kind of strange to say what's business related.
I know.
Because you never
Life.
Know
every
what,
day.
You never know, even at the time, what stupid thing you do is going to find its way into your work. But other things are very clearly done for your work, and travel is one of them. But you know, the bad thing is you don't usually make that much money. And so, you know, deducting your youth hostel expenses is not as glamorous as it sounds.
They used to say that, especially about those big ticket writers, you know, every, you know, the pop novelists who would, every novel would be in a different set of countries. And it was clear that was just because they were traveling to those countries and could write it off that way. Sonia, I want to ask you a question about when you deciding to be a writer, a poet in Croatia. It must be very different than the experience you see in places like Omaha of people who have these MFAs and all that kind of thing. I mean, it must be a totally different commitment to decide to become a poet.
Yes, it is. But I somehow decided it very early when I was very young. And then I just continued writing, and I wrote poetry and fiction and, short stories and novels and some books for children. And I did some writing for radio. That means all sorts of things, because being a freelance writer in Croatia is quite a tough job.
So it is a tough job even there.
Yeah, but we do have some sort of grants from the Ministry of Culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, the state is trying to give some money to culture, which is not big money, but still you may... Well, while you were talking about historical novels, I wrote one too. But at the time, I had a grant of the Ministry of Culture, so I could travel and have enough time to do it, which is otherwise pretty hard to do.
So is there a structure for MFAs and that kind of equivalent of that in Croatia?
They are trying to establish some now. Oh. It's been about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years since the process is sort of going on. But it's not done still because, well, first of all, country is quite poor.
Right.
So opening new universities and things like that isn't, well, it's expensive. And then the people, people of the book world are not entirely, they don't entirely agree about that thing, should it be done or not. So
right.
We'll see.
Yeah. No, what I also wonder is, in a country as small as Croatia, is the literary world pretty much self-contained? I mean, do you all kind of know each other and sustain each other? And
yeah, and that's a big, big difficulty. We all know each other. It's very closed, and it's very hard to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the problem of the small language.
Yeah.
Because
you're saying, is it hard to get into it at first?
Well, not so much, but it's hard to get readers because there are not many of them. And then
it's kind of like the poetry world here. They're all just reading each other.
Poetry world is everywhere the same as far as I have seen. It's always a minority group, actually.
Yeah.
But even with novels, it's still difficult. And it's difficult to offer something on the international market because you always have to have translations and you have to have some sort of relationship to people. And so it's really tough.
They've done an incredible thing in this country. They've created so many poetry writing programs that now we have readers for all the poets.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, is that too cynical? Do you have an MFA, Justin?
No, I think it's going to become ever more the case that people will always have them, simply because the more people, it'll just be more weird not to do it,
right?
Because it's just a more of an, you know, it's going to become more normal, and so it will take a more active resistance. Like you'll have had to decide that you weren't going to do it and that you were going to like resist it in like a very specific way. Whereas I feel like even, you know, maybe 10 years ago when I started writing, of course they were around, but the fact that everybody's doing them, maybe if I was starting now instead of a few years ago, I would do it because it's mm-hmm. just easier, you know. I mean, you have some things against you don't know people, I mean, which
right.
you don't have a community. I mean, there's one side of it, which is just what you need to get published and to have the support of your teachers, but there's also just the community of other writers. And if you start without it, then you can feel like an outsider, because I'm not friends with a bunch of other people who didn't do MFAs because mm-hmm. everybody did MFAs,
right? Well, I remember when I was in graduate school, the MFA thing was just sort of happening, and the mainstream English department treated them like, you know, like dirt. They weren't well treated, and they didn't actually give them MFAs till a couple of years later, after a couple MAs were given in creative writing, and those people couldn't get jobs because they wanted an MFA. And famously, one of them was Breeze Pancake, if you're familiar with him. That was part of what depressed him, was he didn't have an MFA. Anyway, Ellen?
Well, this has been really a lot of fun and very interesting. And I just want to remind our listeners that they can hear writers read and enjoy the barbecue and get to talk to some of the residents on Saturday, May 16th, is next Saturday at 5 p.m. at OMAI International Arts Center in Ghent.
And where can we see DW?
DW is going to be at the Chatham Bookstore on the 15th. At what time?
I believe that's 5 o'clock as well. Yeah.
Right.
No barbecue, but perhaps some wine and cheese.
That sounds very gentrification-y.
<It does. laughs>
Thank you so much for coming. We've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Well, Alan, while you escort our guests out, I'll play a song that kind of has a literary motif. Where is it?